ahead and take the speed up your number one now, runway 27 clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems. I'm one of your hosts, Hal Bryan, EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. And over there at the next table, it is...
I'm Chris Henry, the EAA Aviation Museum director.
And Chris, we are joined today in person, which is always so much fun, by a new friend and colleague, Grace Yakuber, who works in our chapters department and coming up, I believe, pretty soon, if not just past your 1 month anniversary.
I've been here 1 month officially as of 2 days ago.
Well, Grace, once again, welcome and welcome to the show. We're really glad to have you. And you've got a cool story behind you that I think everybody's going to be really excited to hear.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me.
It is our pleasure. I'm looking at Chris, make sure he agrees.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I hope so. Okay.
It's officially unanimous. We're glad you're here. So now, Grace, your job title, you are a chapter field representative.
I am a chapter field representative, and I came into this position. Somebody had tipped me off at Oshkosh, and that person was my chapter president of 234 over in Traverse City, Michigan. And he said, hey, EA has a really great opportunity. They're looking for somebody to fill a position. Serena Camps, Brulette, yes. Married since then. She was having a baby, and she knew that she was going to be leaving EAA, and they had to fill her position. And so they were looking for the right personality to bring to the chapters department. And my president, he comes to Oshkosh every year, comes about a month ahead of time, and he's one of those diehard volunteers. And he texted me and said, you need to come over to the Blue Barn and meet John Egan. He is our manager of our chapters department, him and Charlie Becker. And I wandered over to the Blue Barn and I met John and we hit it off great. And I went back to my camper and I filled out the application. And then a month later, I was deciding to move to Oshkosh.
That's great. And we, you know, outside of this, we've talked a lot about relocating and things like that. And all three of us on the mic at this point are transplants who came here, you know, specifically drawn here to EAA because we're excited about the mission and we believe in it and we're into this stuff. We want to get in a little bit to your aviation background, but you mentioned you're talking to your chapter president. So you were somebody who was involved in your local chapter quite a bit for quite a while before starting here on staff.
Very much so. Chapter 234 was not doing very well when I came into it in 2019. I had moved to Traverse City from Mackinac Island for college. And that first summer that I was in Traverse City was the first exposure I had to an EAA chapter. And they didn't have a home. We were just operating out of the terminal and just a little conference room for a monthly meeting. And I decided to become a member and see how I could help out with the local community, because while I was going through college, I didn't quite get the community aspect that I was really hoping for in aviation. So I really kind of turned EAA to kind of fulfill that part of me that wanted to be part of my community. Since then, over the last 6 years now, we are a gold chapter. So we are part of a lot of community events. We participate very heavily with Young Eagles. So it's been really cool to watch them grow over the years.
Great.
I think that's interesting what you touch on, that you look to EAA for the sort of camaraderie or the social aspect of aviation. I did the same thing when I was working as a controller over in Elkhart, Indiana. You know, the guys I worked with were great, but when they went home, they were kind of done with planes. And as the three of us are sitting here, we all know that that's not how our lives work, where it's like, I want more planes, you know, and the EA chapter was part of that. So I guess what I'd want to say is, like, what was it like walking into your first EA meeting? Like, how did you feel? Were you welcomed pretty well and everything?
Yeah, it was a little intimidating. I was the youngest person there by 50 years. So a very different environment, and especially being a little 19-year-old at the time who had never been a part of an EAA chapter, I wasn't really sure if I was going to be welcome or not, if I was going to go to one meeting and then turn around and say, yep, that wasn't for me. But immediately I met Jim Sorby and Bill Ross. Bill Ross was our president at the time, and he still is. He's one of our longest standing presidents of 234. And then Jim Sorby was our vice president at the time, and he was also kind of jump-starting our Young Eagles, and he is now our Young Eagles coordinator still to this day. So they're still both longstanding members of our chapter, and they made it a very comfortable environment for somebody very new to the EAA community. And I had already been going to Oshkosh for years, so I knew what EAA was, but I wasn't really familiar with the chapter side of it.
That's so nice to hear, because it's that's what it should be. And I mean, you're here now to help define what chapters are and support chapters and shape that mission and that vision. And, you know, the chapter, all chapters should be welcoming. They should be so excited to see somebody coming in. And I don't mind saying, especially somebody younger who's going to, you know, maybe breathe some new life and things like that. Now, you mentioned Grace growing up on Mackinac Island. As we're recording this, I'm recently back from my first trip there, thanks to you and your expert insider tips and recommendations. And I absolutely loved it. For those that don't know, it's an island that's kind of between the upper and lower peninsulas of Michigan. So it's something like 600 full-time residents year-round. Am I close on that?
About 300 to 400 full-time residents.
So 299 to 399 now that you've left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gotcha. doing the math here. But one of the more unusual things about the island is that there's, other than a handful of emergency vehicles, there's no cars, no trucks, there's no motor vehicles really allowed until winter when the snowmobiles come out. But otherwise, it's horses and carriages and things like that. And it's an amazing step back in time. But thankfully for us, they have an airport. So you're living on an island. And I want to talk about, I want you to relate that story of how do you manage to learn to fly in that environment. But take us into that by letting us know what got your attention about aviation. Because as I understand it, you don't have an aviation background. You don't come from a family of pilots or anything.
Nope, I am the first pilot in my family. It's very unique getting into aviation on Mackinac Island, and it's really cool to come to Oshkosh years ago and try to tell people that I was from Mackinac Island if they asked where you're from. And you kind of get a mixed bag on the responses. Either people are from the Midwest and they're like, oh, Mackinac Island, I was just there last week and I actually stopped there before we came to Oshkosh. And then people not from the Midwest are very confused by, what do you mean, an island with no cars? So I am actually not considered an islander. Islanders is a title reserved for people who have been living on the island pretty much since birth. I was a transplant. I moved there when I was 11 years old. And at the time I had already been bitten by the aviation bug. I was really interested in becoming a commercial airline pilot. And then some old pilot told me that I would never be able to fly an L-1011. So that broke my heart for the first time ever in aviation. So I had to kind of find a different way to maybe get into aviation and fly old airplanes. And it just so happened that when I moved to Mackinac Island, I started school there. And where I was living on the island was about a half mile from the airport. So I wasn't far. I could hear the airplanes taking off and landing. And little 11-year-old, I think maybe 12-year-old, by the time I started actually getting out there to the airport, I was the local ramp rat. And a gentleman at the airport, Mr. Bradley, he was the airport manager, and he taught me how to read a METAR. And I was like, oh, I'm very smart now. I can read a METAR. And so I was hanging out at the airport, reading the METARs every hour, and just kind of meeting a lot of the local pilots. And of course, it's a huge tourist destination, like how you flew up there and you flew the 172 mm-hmm. over there. And so you kind of know that it's a small runway. You're not getting huge airplanes in there. So it's a lot of just local general aviation pilots, which is a great opportunity for a plane crazed 12-year-old to start going and ambushing pilots on the ramp and saying, where'd you come in from? What do you fly? Can I see the cockpit?
It's so cool to hear. And again, that interest coming at that young age without sort of being born into it or led into it in some way. I always find that, I find that really compelling. Now, if I remember correctly, there are no airplanes based on Mackinac Island full time. It's a lovely FBO. Well, not technically an FBO, but a lovely facility.
Right. A little terminal building.
You know, it's run by the Park Service.
Yes, it's run by the state park.
No hangars.
Hangars, no fuel.
And no fuel.
So all we charge for up there, if you ever do fly up there, is the landing fee. And I always recommend you pay it because it does help the small little state park operated airport.
I still have my receipt in my wallet that I'm prepared to
Hal
prove.
Had to bring back the receipt so he could prove that he did help my home airport. So
I wasn't in trouble. But so how do you learn to fly? If you can't go out there and say, you know, here's an instructor and we've got some trainers in the hangar.
Right.
What do you do?
So we operated very heavily with air taxis to get back and forth and charter services to get back and forth during the winter months on Mackinac Island, because a lot of people that have been there understand that the way that you get to the island is through boat. Now, in the wintertime, you can't use the boat all year because the ice eventually freezes over and the boats cannot pass. So you end up relying on airplanes. In the time that I lived up there and utilized the air services, I became very familiar with the pilots, and that right seat was always reserved for me. All of the pilots knew that I wanted to sit up there. And I ended up befriending one of the pilots who was just working a couple seasons up there, and he happened to be a CFI. And I said, hey, do you think you could teach me how to fly? How much do you charge an hour? And he's like, $20. And the person who had owned the air taxi service up there also owned a 150. So just coincidentally, I had a 150 available to me as well as a CFI. And little Grace was working to make $100, whatever it really took to fly that airplane around. So the very unique circumstances under my flight lessons were I lived half a mile away from the airport, and I would text my CFI and say, I want to go on a flight lesson. So he would grab the airplane on the mainland where the airplane was located in St. Ignace, fly to the island, come over to the end of the runway, pick me up while I threw my bike in the woods wherever it would be safe and nobody would steal it. It's Mackinac Island, not much is happening. We would go on a flight lesson for about an hour, and then he would come back, drop me back off on the island, and then he would fly back. And I would still be on the hook for the 0.2, whatever it took to get to and from the island. But that's how I did a good primary part of my training.
That's really amazing. That shows, obviously shows so much dedication. So you're riding your bike to the airport. Were you ever flying in winter? Did you ever have to snowmobile to the airport?
I certainly did. So yeah, glad that you brought that up, because it's a very different place in the wintertime. A lot of people see it in the summertime, but nobody visits in the wintertime, which, Hal, I know that we discussed that you visited just a couple weekends ago, but I really do implore you to visit in the wintertime just because it is so different. We rely very heavily on snowmobiles in the winter months, and when the ferry stopped running, we have to take our snowmobile to the airport, pick up an airplane, go to the mainland, and that's where all of our cars are. We do own cars, and you live on the island, so we're not completely immobile on the mainland. But when you're 12 years old, you can drive a snowmobile if you do not have a driver's license. That's when you can get your permit. And when I lived on the island, I went to a school that had 70 kids in it, K through 12, so just one big hallway full of school kids. When you were 16, you could have the option to go to the mainland and take driver's training. Now, I opted out of that because I was flying at the time, and I thought it would be kind of a cool story if I was, you know, flying before I went driving. So that's kind of how I went about my vehicular use in my youth.
So when did you finally learn to drive?
When I was 19 years old.
Did you already have your private at that
point? I had already gotten my private. By the time I'd moved off to the mainland, I was in Traverse City for college, and I got my private through Northwestern Michigan College. And I completed that in May of 2019, and I got my driver's license November of 2019.
And then on to commercial and instrument as well?
Instrument and commercial. Now, my experience flying after that was a little bit broken down kind of a different way than I think most people might have their training. I opted out of the college route after I completed my private just because it wasn't working out personally for me. So I did my instrument and my commercial independently. But, you know, it's great because it's very rewarding, because once you're a seasoned pilot, you can just fly home to the island anytime you want to. So
that's fantastic.
One thing I do want to mention about learning to fly on Mackinac is that I am, as far as I'm aware, nobody's corrected me on the island quite yet. I'm the first person to solo an airplane on Mackinac Island. So I'm going to take that title as far until somebody, say otherwise. that day I was flying with my instructor, and he asked me if I could do it alone. And I said, yeah, maybe in an emergency. And he said, oh, okay, well, only if you want to. And I didn't realize he was asking me if I wanted to solo. So we got back down to the terminal, and he signed my logbook, and off I went in a little 150. Nobody, on a nice summer's night, nobody was flying to Mackinac Island. And I went around, did my loop, came back down. The sun was setting, so I couldn't do my three touch and goes, but I still flew alone. So I came back, and I had to bike down the taxiway home to my mom and tell her that I'd soloed, and she was so upset with me because I didn't tell her.
How did you feel? Do you remember the feeling you had when you were up there solo for that first time?
I think I actually said out loud, oh my goodness, I'm flying alone. when I did land, I was 17 years old at the time. I had keyed in on the radio and said, if anybody's listening on 122.7, that was my first solo. Nobody responded. So I was just me completely alone. But I always think it's kind of funny that, you know, I thought that that would make a statement because nobody else was around to witness it except for my CFI.
Well, right now, as of this instant, you've got at least thousands of people out there who are saying, good job, Grace.
Aww.
Belated congratulations. So we'll say it on their behalf, Chris.
Absolutely.
Well, I certainly appreciate it.
Loaded question. Do you remember the tail number?
714 Sierra Hotel.
Isn't it weird? Do you always remember the tail number or your solo?
Yeah. She was a
5294 Quebec.
Yeah. 5-2 Quebec. I like that one. That's a good
9-4 Quebec. 5-2-9-4 Quebec. Yeah.
I was November 5712 uniform. That was, you always remember it.
Now we're all just sort of wistfully looking.
I know, exactly. Like, wonder where it is now.
Yeah, wonder what the audience is thinking right now. Yeah. Well, hopefully, I'm just staring into space.
Hopefully they're thinking about their tail numbers.
I hope so. And boy, if you haven't soloed out there, go for it. Yeah. Just absolutely good. Get out there and learn to fly.
So, Hal, when you were flying to Mackinac Island just a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. what were your first thoughts as you were flying over the bridge because you were coming from the west?
Right.
Flying to the island, what was it like?
It was just the beauty of it. And what's it's interesting you mentioned the bridge in particular, because I'm fascinated by things like that. As a little kid, I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, so the Golden Gate Bridge is this sort of personal landmark for me that I've always thought was stunningly pretty, and the Mackinac Bridge is magnificent to look at. What's funny, though, and this is hard for a lot of people to wrap their heads around, so I'm a pilot, as all of us are, and I've been involved in it my entire life. I was one of those people who was born into it. But as a little kid, and then even like last time I was there 5-6 years ago, driving across the Golden Gate Bridge, like I love it and it's beautiful, but I get a little bit of vertigo. I get a little bit of a weird height sensation. It's like something about it being elevated and you're a few hundred feet over the water and then looking up and getting a little dizzy when you see these big structures above you. And so it was interesting to be, half a mile above the Mackinac Bridge and looking down and just admiring it. And I was laughing at myself because, okay, I'm way higher, but this to me is the most comfortable view. Whereas driving across it, I would enjoy it, but I'd have a little bit of that feeling in the pit of my stomach. So, but admiring the bridge from that angle was spectacular. And then just seeing the island. So it was left traffic for 2-6. And so that put, the island and the harbor and the downtown and the fort and the Grand Hotel, put all that stuff on my side.
And then your wife's looking over at Round Island and Pablo Island.
Exactly. She's looking out the right side and everything else. And there was a reasonable amount of traffic, but everybody was easygoing and we were talking to each other a little bit. Hey, you're behind me, but I'm above you and you're faster than me. So Bonanza, why don't you pull ahead and I'll be number two behind you and all that kind of stuff. So that's, we're not locals, but that's also helped set the tone. But really, to circle back to your question, I was just blown away by the beauty of it. I mean, pictures don't do it justice. And then also I was reveling in the fact that we have this option. We have this vantage point that not everybody does. And it's not an elitist thing. It's just it's something we have to remind ourselves and celebrate. We can see the world from that point of view. And also the fact that this was from point to point for me out of Oshkosh was just a hair over 2 hours. And it would have been, I think it's 5.5 hour drive to get to the ferry from here. And then you're waiting for the ferry and all that kind of stuff. It's not impossible if somebody says, I'm going to be crazy and I'm going to drive from Oshkosh to Mackinac just for lunch. But it's a little much. But to be able to fly, have lunch, spend a few hours, and then just come back that day was... to me, it was as good a testament to why we do what we do as anything.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned like the we're not elitist, and we're personal friends on and off the air, But I always like your posts because your posts never come off that way. They're always like, "This is really beautiful, and I hope you want to do this too." And here's how you should do it. I mean, that's the beauty of EAA is, and your posts are always in that tone of. This is really cool. I hope you want to do this. Here's how you do this. Come to EAA. And I always love that you do that. And that's just a cool way that you do that.
I appreciate that quite a bit, Chris. And you're very active on social as well. And speaking of that, Grace, before I lose track of it, you have an avid following on Instagram. And I would put you in that same category of being sort of very authentic. And, it's not... you're not out there saying, look at me, I'm an influencer and I'm just going to point the camera at my face every time. It is Morgan. So how do people find you on Instagram?
So the Instagram story started about the same time I moved to Mackinac Island. So I was in middle school and then everybody gets an Instagram in middle school. And
we did not.
We had a different experience.
Yeah.
I had a Teddy Graham in high school.
I don't know what you guys were doing in high school.
Totally different.
Yeah. But, I was probably wearing Garanimals. I don't know.
Yeah. Social media, it kind of is a staple now, obviously, you know, in your teenage years. And I started that, and it was about the same time I got into aviation. And I discovered that being a little girl on the island, the only way I could connect with other aviation enthusiasts was really through social media. That's where I made a bulk of my friends. That's where I was able to really share my story. That's where I kind of decided that my social media was going to be my portfolio for my life. It wasn't going to be anything that I'm trying to go out there and tell everybody, hey, you know, here's everything that I do and you should, you know, do it as well. But it's just kind of like, here's something that you can do. And here's something that, you know, the way I chose to go about my aviation career, it's not the same as everybody else's, but I want to make sure that that option is open to them. So it was just kind of a cool way to exhibit a very unique lifestyle and be able to show people that you can persevere and still have a grand career in aviation. So it's very rewarding.
And if they want to follow you on Instagram, your username is?
Or the Northern Aviator.
The Northern Aviator.
Which now I live in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, so I don't know if that's going to have to change.
you're still north of a lot of things.
I'm so. North enough. Right.
You know, before we move on, I just want to take a minute and say thanks to our sponsor, Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use coupon code GREEN15, that's GREEN15, at crewchiefsystems.com. Thanks again to Crew Chief Systems for really stepping up and helping us at EA keep this podcast going.
So, Grace, while you were learning to fly up in this absolutely gorgeous part of the country, is there a certain flight or a moment on one of your flights that just really stands out for you?
Well, when I first got signed off to solo, my instructor was very, very casual. It was very casual flight training. And so he actually signed me off so I could fly between the mainland and the island as much as I wanted to. And I was kind of stretching my wings and pushing my boundaries a little bit of where I could fly. And he just said, you know, go practice maneuvers if you want to. Go practice landings if you want to. You have two airports that you could choose from. So there's a lot of water crossing. So you get very comfortable in a 150 crossing the water. But there was this one time, there was a soccer game from my school. They were doing a soccer game up at Turtle Park, which is kind of in the middle of the island. And they advised that you do not fly over the middle of the island. But young Grace was like, well, nobody's in the pattern. It's just me. Everybody down there knows me. This should be fine, right? And it's just an advisory. Don't fly over the island. But I decided to go and fly over the soccer field and kind of rock my wings for my friends to see while I was coming in to land over on 26. And that was just really cool to know that my friends in high school were down there. My, you know, my friends' parents, my parents, I think, might have been down there as well watching. And then not just me going, I was practicing a solo flight and coming into land. And I just got to show everybody like, hey, this is, you know, a cool thing that I get to do is fly over my friends and the people that support me on this aviation journey. And it's just kind of a nice little like, thank you to where you guys put me in the air. So that was a very gratifying moment to fly over Mackinac Island and kind of get an oversight of the people that I was a big part of for 6 years. So
and nobody called in any noise complaints.
No noise complaints. They usually saw a little green 150 and they said, there's Grace. But
who was your first passenger?
My first passenger. Oh goodness. So this would have been when I moved to Traverse City, I got my license. You know, I guess technically my first non-pilot passenger was my dad, but that would have been about a year or so after I got my pilot's license. Oh, wow. I was one of those people that took a long time to take people up. I was always flying with my pilot friends and just kind of learning proficiency that way, because there's no better way to learn than two little private pilots trying to figure out how to fly an airplane together. But I think it was my dad. We went to a Father's Day pancake breakfast. So I know. And we got out of the airplane, everybody's going up to him asking, hey, do you need the fuel? And he's like, I don't know about fuel. Grace, do we need fuel? And I'm like, no, Dad, we don't need fuel, because the assumption was that he was the pilot and I was probably the student. I'm not sure. But who did you guys take up?
It's my dad. My dad was the first person that ever went with me up in an airplane. My mom was afraid of flying, so oddly enough. So
I have not taken my mother up yet either.
Yeah, for me, it was my college roommate and one of our best friends at the time, because I was, you know, was doing this in college. And then my dad was a career airline pilot, but I, you know, got to take him later and got to take both my parents up together once. And then, you know, many, many years later, when I started getting more serious about flying old biplanes and stuff like that, gave my wife and my dad their first rides in a 1941 de Havilland Tiger Moth. And that was, that felt like that whole first passenger moment sort of all over again, even though I'd been flying for 20 years at that point, 25 years, something like that. So
I remember the absolutely ridiculous feeling of my first solo cross country feeling like Charles Lindbergh. Like, I just couldn't explain it, where I was like, I am going off to explore Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, yes, and nobody has discovered anything north of Beaver County Airport, you know. It's a wild feeling, like that first time you're good. This first solo is always special, I think, because it's you can do this, you can fly the airplane, but there's something about going somewhere that first time by yourself that just feels like a little scary. Like, I'm leaving and I'm going to go to, like,
you're on a mission.
I was going to Akron, you know. It was just like, oh, this is, I hope I can find Akron, you know.
Once you do it.
Oh, once you do it, you know.
You feel great.
Yeah. For me, it was seeing the big blimp hangar up there, the air dock. Yeah. I was like,
that's
okay.
That's really neat. Know,
I chose it on purpose, but yeah. Where did you go for your, where would you go for your first, like, solo cross country?
So I didn't complete my private pilot's license on the island. I was in Traverse City by that time. So I was still flying around in northern Michigan, which was very familiar to me even still to this day. It's very strange flying over here, even though it's still the Midwest. But I think I flew, where I did my first solo cross country, one of the 3 points was Oscoda, Michigan, which is a former, military base. It's got a 10,000 foot runway. Kalita, is a cargo service that operates out of there. They use, like, maintenance, facilities there, but it's a really long runway. So you're kind of coming in and you're coming in on a normal approach and you're like, I'm just going to land on the numbers. And then you kind of get halfway down and you're like, you know, I think I'm going to land at the end of the runway, which is, you know, not a normal decision you would make, but it's so long. You don't want to have that taxi be forever. You're going to get lost somewhere over there. So that was a very unique little experience for a you know, student pilot. But Hal and I kind of brought this discussion up last week about flying in places you're familiar with and then kind of challenging yourself to fly in other locations that you're not so familiar with. We kind of talked about how here in Oshkosh, we have the lake, at least to use as a reference point. Obviously, I'm used to a couple more lakes than just the one here.
And, you know, and a couple of bigger ones.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Although, you know, for us, if you have the smaller lake on your left and the huge lake on your right, you're going north.
Yeah.
You know, we've got that to reference.
But there's some really beautiful flying to be had out here in Wisconsin. I did get my Wisconsin passport. I forgot to tell you guys that outside the podcast, but I will tell you on the podcast, I have gotten my Wisconsin airport passport. So I get to start actually logging all my adventures here in Wisconsin flying around.
Start collecting your stamps. That's great.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's nice to see, you know, how many states are finding programs like that to just encourage people to go out and use, you know, use GA airports, bring more visibility to GA airports. And, you know, not to retread the earlier topic that much, but I think it's really important to stress that general aviation, to some people, it seems like it's incongruous. There's only horses on the island, but you've got an airport, but it's vital to that island for a big chunk of the year, right?
Absolutely. And it's not only Mackinac Island. There's a lot of islands in Michigan that people who live in Michigan sometimes haven't heard of, that people actually reside on. Beaver Island is a huge island that a lot of people will go for tourism reasons, but there's also a large amount of people that do live there. It was one of the few islands that we played sports with when I lived on Mackinac and was in high school. So we would actually fly to and from Beaver Island, and they would come over to our island and fly over to play sports, which was very unique growing up and kind of having to deal with the weather for maybe a volleyball game. I don't know. Right. So it was very weather dependent. But there's North Fox Island, which is it's operated by the Recreation Aviation Foundation, which is a very unique island as well in northwest Michigan, probably a couple miles north of the Leelanau Peninsula. So it's a neat airport to visit if you ever just want to be very remote. Bablo Island and Round Island. Round Island doesn't have a runway, but Bablo does. It's the two islands south of Mackinac.
Oh, okay.
So if you saw that, your wife probably saw it while you were flying in the 2-6 there.
Yes.
But they just make sure you do a wildlife check there because there are a lot of deer. It's one of the airports that I would go and practice landing at when I didn't want to stay on the island. But Michigan has a lot to offer aviation-wise, and general aviation is definitely still a huge part of the industry that is up and coming in Michigan. So like if we take advantage of the passport program someday, I wouldn't be surprised.
That's fantastic. I briefly lived in Michigan, and I think...
Was it the best brief moment of your life?
It was a moment. but Michigan and Wisconsin, especially, you know, northern Wisconsin, I encourage a lot of people that, you know, anybody that's flying GA to come check it out, especially like in the fall or the spring. Like, it's absolutely gorgeous here. Yeah. You know, just really beautiful flying here.
And for those of us who grew up flying in other areas with, you know, mountainous terrain and stuff, it's a different kind of beauty. But there is a lot of beauty to a literally unlimited number of emergency landing spots in every direction, like we have here, you know, here in Wisconsin. It's just, you know, heaven forbid we have an engine out, something like that. We've got to make an off-airport landing. You know, your toughest decision is, you know, which kind of crop will I land on? It's like, what are the soybeans, the alfalfa, you know, what have you?
What's being harvested soon?
Yes, exactly.
In Pennsylvania, you know, we have a lot of hills, a lot of mountains, so though not as many... quite as many farms and where I was from. And I just remember, like, you know, Route 60 was like, yeah, if the highway looks clear, you know, use the highway. It's going to be like your, which isn't great, but it was like the best, you know, one of the better options. And yeah, when you came out here, you're just like, oh, you just kind of go anywhere. Like, you know, look for, you know, someplace without trees.
Feels safer to fly in this kind of area.
It is. It is.
And the odds are really good. There's going to be a grass strip somewhere like right underneath you too. There's so many great grass strips out there.
I was amazed. We were talking about the beauty of the flying out in this area though. Tom and I took the 172 and we went up north and,
not to Mackinac.
We went to like Thunder Bay. And it was really like, it was amazing. The water's like turquoise. Like, I mean, it was like, you looked like it was like in the Bahamas or something like that. It was wild. You wouldn't think that type of water color was here in our area, but
you almost think it's the Caribbean.
Right. Yeah, it's surprising. Like there's one of the beaches on Washington Island, Education Beach, has got this white rocky beach and the water is absolutely Caribbean turquoise. And it's, that was a real surprise to me too.
Yeah.
Again, you know, being all of us being transplants of one form or another.
Yeah.
Grace.
How?
The hardest. Yes. Let's get serious for
I'm
a moment, shall
now.
We?
Let's go. Right.
Oh, great. Oh, great. She's comfortable. Now what do I do? A hard question. Is there a dream airplane? Is there one thing out there that you say that, boy, more than almost anything else, that's what I want to fly?
A bird dog.
Oh, that's cool.
Chris already knows about this. Chris, the first time that I ever met Chris, I purposefully walked into his office. Somebody had actually shown me where your office was. And I marched down there on a day that I knew you were going to be there. And, you know, within 30 seconds, he was like, you want to come into the hangar? And so then, you know, before you know it, I'm getting a tour of Paul's P-51. And he's talking to me about airplanes that we have in the museum. And I'm like, you're missing a bird dog. We're talking about Vietnam era aircraft. And I'm like, you're really missing a bird dog. But I fell in love with bird dogs at Oshkosh. I've been coming to Oshkosh since I was 14 years old. So it's been a huge staple in every single one of my summers since then. And there's always a great bird dog display. So many people bring in those beautifully refurbished bird dogs. And they're just really, really neat pieces of history and just really cool airplanes. I've never flown one. And so I have a lot to say about an aircraft I've never flown, but it is my dream airplane to own one day.
I love it because it's truly like GA went to war with
absolutely.
It's like a Cessna 170.
That 170 like, that worked out for a while.
Right.
And everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just did a bird dog feature not too long ago in Warbirds and Warbirds magazine. And so I've never flown one. I have shot photos from one riding backwards in the rear seat, which was kind of interesting.
Oh, wow.
But
very versatile aircraft now.
Yeah, they sure are.
Now that they're not used for actual.
And also the new staffers, when they come and like come to the museum and they want to talk to the museum folks, usually it's like, can we look at like the P-51, which is pretty famous airplane. It's a good, you know, airplane to go out and talk about. I don't want to say entry level, but as far as like history, but it's well known, right? I don't get it. A lot of people like Grace who comes in and one is like, you guys need a bird dog in the museum. And you're just like, what? And then it's like, when can I see the Ford Flipper? You know, and you're like two odd aircraft that, you know, like you don't hear a ton of people requesting a lot.
So the Ford Flipper, it's just so interesting to me because it's just such a silly looking airplane. Now, the reason I know about the Ford Flipper is because I just came from a job working in Southeast Michigan and they had the Ford Flipper there in the Dearborn Museum, the Henry Ford Museum. And so the one that you guys have is a built replica. And to circle back into what I do now with EAA, it was built by a chapter in Michigan back in the 90s, I want to say. I would love to know their purpose someday of why they decided that they wanted to rebuild and kind of a scale model of the Ford Flipper and then bring it over here to Oshkosh. I want to know what the thought process was to that. But it's just a very silly looking airplane. It was the everyman's airplane, of course, and it's got a very unique history, kind of an unfortunate history to it. But how privileged you guys are to have it in a little barn just across from Pioneer Airport. So,
and I love that 1-2 punch of, hi, I'm Grace. Here's one thing that's wrong with your museum.
Yes, yeah.
And then here's something really obscure. Yeah, and you're standing there, my name's Chris.
Yeah.
Hello.
I think my next reply was hi.
Yes, exactly. Well, Grace is a force of nature. Yeah. You haven't picked up on that so far.
We were walking around the museum and Chris is offering up, like, if you want to get up close and personal with any of these airplanes, you just let me know and I can try to make it happen. And I'm like pointing to the ceiling at the little, the champ, you know, the little military champ that's in the corner. L5, and then I'm like, what about L5, like Art Scholl's chipmunk? Right. And he's just kind of like shaking his head. He's
pointing to stuff that's hanging upside down.
Upside down. But,
and I was like, I was thinking something
said,
that I just need a stepladder to get to, you know?
Hey, we bring scissor lifts in.
I know.
Nothing's impossible.
I can't wait to talk
impossible.
To risk management. Like, we're going to hang Grace upside down.
Yeah.
Out in the in Archul's airplane.
And know? We're pretty sure it'll be fine.
It should be okay.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible being able to have the opportunity to work here at EAA, though, especially part of the chapters department. Being so familiar with chapters at my hometown and being so involved and really understanding how chapters work, being able to come here and then, you know, I have to go run to accounting. I get to run through the museum. That's such a privilege. And I was doing it yesterday and I told myself, please, Grace, never get sick of this. Like, don't just think you're jaded right now, because I still think in 6 months I'm going to have the same reaction. And I think in a year I'm going to have the same reaction. I think in 10 years, same reaction. So,
and you know, how you've been here a little bit longer than I, but, you know, I've been here 13 years and, you know, there are areas that sometimes you, it just becomes like, yes, you know, I have to go over here and I'll walk through the museum, but you don't lose that. I mean, I'll walk through the museum even like later today to get here to record this. And you're still like, that's cool. Like we're looking at the Bugatti or whatever as you're walking through, or, it's interesting for AirVenture. We move some aircraft that are in the Pioneer side and it's a replica, but your brain doesn't allow you to go this way. Like when we're moving the Spear to St. Louis, your brain is like, dude, you're moving the Spear of St. Louis right now.
Careful.
You're just, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, all right, I gotta go move the Declaration of Independence over here. You know, I don't think you ever get tired of it. No. Hal.
As you said, so I've been here a little bit longer. I've been here 16 years now. And then was, you know, an attendee and visitor every year for 11 or 12 years prior to that. And to me, just walking through the museum is one of the many perks of working here. It's recharging.
They should really list it as one of the benefits.
It really should be. And you know, maybe not everybody sees it that way, but I think we're the three of a kind here that we do, in that, you know, if I'm, you know, plugging away in my office and working on something and kind of heads down and I need to clear my head for a minute. You know, maybe I'll just take the long way to the restroom and duck through part of the museum. And it's always the same for me. It's the same as when I haven't flown for a while and then I fly again and I have this little, what I call the, oh yeah, that's right moment. Just that thing that says, yeah, okay, this is why we're here. This is why we do what we do. And, you know, I can get that from almost any any airplane, any aircraft, any artifact in the museum. And then I get a related feeling again, if I haven't flown for some time and then I get back in, it's like, oh, this is why we do all of this. This is why every one of us comes to work every day. And speaking of that, Grace, as we're getting closer to the end of the episode, what are your goals at EAA? You know, as I said at the beginning, you know, you came to us with a strong aviation background with experience in EAA chapters. You have a deep insight into what chapters are. So what do you, how will you define your success at EAA?
I'm going to give you a pretty long-winded answer to that, so don't let me lose track entirely. But for the last 10 years or so that I've been coming to Air Venture, and I have to learn how to call it Air Venture and not just Oshkosh.
We still just say Oshkosh. It's fine.
Or the convention.
Yes.
Yeah. Convention. Whenever I had the opportunity to become available to make my way to the museum, I wander over here. One of the most impactful exhibits that I believe is here is in the upstairs in the pavilion, and it's the little chapters map. And I always stood in front of it and kind of looked around, looked at all these different patches that have made their way to EAA from a plethora of chapters. I always just thought that was really interesting that every single one of these little communities, you know, put their artistic creativeness together and they made a patch and then they had the foresight to be like, we need to send one to HQ. They send one over here. I just thought that was so interesting. And so for the last couple of years, I've been working in private aviation. I come from charter sales, working with private jets and whatnot. And it's really fun. But it wasn't fulfilling my goals in aviation that I wanted for a career long term. So when this job became available and I had a long discussion with a lot of my friends at Oshkosh about the right way that I might want to go in aviation long term, I really want to start thinking about that and making sure that I have a lasting legacy in aviation. That is my long term goal, is to make sure that I leave aviation better than I found it. That's how everybody wants to come in aviation. They want to make their impact in a positive way and then be able to leave and say, I did good. And when the job became available and I had the long talk with John about coming into chapters and what the purpose of chapters was, it is wholeheartedly to help communities nationwide and beyond, because we have a couple of international chapters. But every single one of those chapters has the core values of EAA to inspire general aviation, or they say the spirit of aviation. But it's really cool to be able to finally contribute to that, something that I feel in my heart is what I was meant to do, bringing communities together. There's so many different people of different walks of life that come in aviation. And a lot of times that first exposure is through a chapter. And so it can have a huge impact on kids going through the Ray Scholarship Program, you know, from the Young Eagles, individuals looking to get back into flying, people who just are mildly interested in talking about airplanes every Saturday for coffee. And every single person has every right to be there as a part of aviation. So it's really cool to be able to be in chapters. And my primary focus is helping chapters start up. So I get to single-handedly be the person to help create this opportunity for communities. If they do the heavy lifting and they want to do it, I get to help them actually create that center point within their airport and within their community. You don't need an airport from EAA chapter, by the way, but it's preferred. But it's really, really neat to be able to help with that cause.
If somebody out there is listening and they've been maybe thinking about working with some friends and starting a local EAA chapter, we send them to eaa.org/chapters. Any other specific advice, any other instructions for them?
Yeah, so we have a chapter interest form that anybody is welcome to fill out. I encourage anybody who is even mildly interested in starting a chapter that just wants more information to fill it out. You know, the baseline for starting a chapter is you need 10 members, 10 active EAA members to start a normal chapter. It doesn't take a lot. It just takes a lot of commitment. So really that interest in having that first conversation, I think, is the hardest step. You know, just for example, this last week, we had a young lady from North Dakota reach out. She's in her early 20s. You know, I'm just a little bit older than her. And she just said she was kind of vaguely interested in starting an EAA chapter. We got to open up this conversation. And I couldn't applaud her enough for having that courage to just reach out and see what it takes to start a community chapter that helps encourage aviation. So I think it's really neat that people, even a little bit younger, are still part of that discussion.
That is great to hear. And it's vital if we want this whole thing that we're all so much in love with to continue. So with that, Grace, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. If it doesn't seem too over the top, thank you for coming to EAA. There's no doubt in my mind from the moment we met that you were going to add a lot to this organization. And we appreciate what you bring to the role.
I'm super excited to be here. So thank you very much.
Well, it's again, Chris, it's our pleasure, right? We agreed on that at the beginning.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Right.
Thanks also to everyone out there for listening, especially those of you that take the time to send us some feedback, which you can do at feedback@eaa.org. Every one of these episodes has a landing page on our blog at inspire.eaa.org. You can also connect to EAA just about everywhere on social media. And if you've got some ideas or comments there, we also really, really appreciate the reviews on iTunes or wherever you consume your podcasts. The fact that we get such good feedback and such good response is the very reason we're able to continue doing the show. Thanks once again, of course, to our sponsor, Crew Chief Systems, and everyone out there one more time for listening and taking the time to let us be part of your day and part of your aviation journey. So with that and our ongoing thanks, we'll catch up to you next time when you're cleared to land
on the green dot.